As always, the opinions expressed in this program do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of DKI APCSS, the U.S. Department of Defense, or the U.S. government.
In preparing Taiwan's own defense, I think this administration is doing a good job in their annual military drill called Hanglong. Before this version, it's always 5 days. This version, 10. First 4 days, it's Taiwanese response to intense gray zone, PLA gray zone operations turned invasion.
Aloha, and welcome to Dialogue, where conversations shape security. I'm your host, James Minnick, Colonel of the United States Army, retired, and professor here at the Daniel K. Inouye Asia Pacific Center for Security Studies in Honolulu, Hawaii. This is episode 46, Taiwan, Democracy and Deterrence. Taiwan today stands at a defining intersection where the enduring strength of its democracy meets the evolving demands of deterrence in a precarious regional environment. Internally, Taiwan's democratic institutions are being tested, not by crisis, but by contestation. The 2024 election delivered a split verdict. President Lai Ching-te was elected with a solid mandate, but his Democratic Progressive Party lost its legislative majority. This outcome ushered in only the third period of divided government in Taiwan's democratic history. That division is playing out in real time, with competing legislative agendas and control of key committees in opposition's hands. The early months of the Lai administration have seen frequent gridlock. Tensions have escalated further with the launch of what's being called the Grand Recall Campaign, an effort led by civil society groups and DPP-aligned organizers to unseat dozens of opposition lawmakers from the Kuomintang. Supporters say it's about defending democratic accountability. Critics argue it's a dangerous use of legal tools to punish dissent and consolidate power. Either way, the campaign is reshaping Taiwan's political climate and public discourse. But Taiwan's challenges don't stop at home. Across the strait, the People's Liberation Army continues near daily incursions into Taiwan's air defense identification zones, its ATIZs. In 2024 alone, the PLA logged over 5,100 sorties, an airborne metronome designed to normalize coercion, wear down defenses, and test Taiwan's resolve. These are not isolated incidents. They're part of a broader pattern of gray zone activity meant to constrain Taiwan's international space without triggering direct conflict. In parallel, Taiwan faces an increasingly complex landscape of espionage threats, with recent cases involving active duty officers and even surveillance of top officials abroad. Amid this pressure, Taiwan is reassessing how it balances political will, fiscal capacity, and defense requirements. The current defense budget stands at 2.38% of GDP, but calls from U.S. officials have urged Taiwan to raise that figure to 3.4% or even 10%, a level that Premier Cho has called financially impossible. These conversations reflect not just questions of dollars and weapons, but also of strategic credibility, deterrence timelines, and burden sharing between Taiwan and its international partners, especially the United States. At the same time, Taiwan's younger generations are reshaping its identity from the inside out. Polling consistently shows that a growing majority of youth identify as distinctly Taiwanese, not Chinese, an identity shift with profound implications for national policy, cross-strait relations, and how the island sees its place in the world. For some, the stakes are existential. For others, this is simply the natural evolution of a confident, self-governing democracy charting its own courses. So today we're asking, how is Taiwan navigating its domestic divisions and external pressures? What does deterrence look like when democracy is both your strength and your vulnerability? And how are leaders and citizens thinking about sovereignty, security, and the future? To help us explore these questions, I'm joined by Howard Shen, a political analyst and former foreign policy fellow at Taiwan's Legislative UN's Foreign Affairs and National Defense Committee on the Kuomintang staff, and he's an intern here at APCSS. He's written extensively and brings deep insights into Taiwan's domestic politics, U.S.-Taiwan relations, and the evolving strategic equation in the Indo-Pacific. Howard Shin, welcome to Dialogue.
Thanks so much, Dr. Minnick. Thank you for having me here.
Man, it is. I've been looking forward to this episode since you got here.
Oh, absolutely. Like, the sentiment is mutual.
Well, you, I note, and our viewers will probably note, we're just recently on a videocast podcast and sat down, and I watched it. I thought you were extremely conversant in those areas that you were responsible for. So maybe you might walk us through. Tell us a little bit about how you came into this space. What is your story?
Right. No, absolutely. I got interested in foreign policy, international relations when I was very little, high school, Model UN, the classic story.
That's a good story.
But I started working. So the first internship I ever had was with the Taiwanese Ministry of Justice Investigation Bureau, Cross Taiwan Strait Division. And that really opened my eyes to the extent of the threat that Taiwan is facing. And I felt obligated to respond to these threats as I grow up. To help secure my country, to help defend not just my family, people I love, but also this nation as a whole. And by the time I went to Taipei for work, I understood that the KMT's foreign policy, defense policy aligned more in my belief. So I started off in their Department of International Affairs, worked my ways up, and most recently, I was director of the KMT representative office in the United States. And during the 2024 Taiwanese presidential election cycle, I was foreign press secretary of the KMT's presidential candidate, Hoyo Yi. I remember I was hosting more than 300 journalists in our international press conference, along with a legislative candidate and our foreign policy advisor. So it was such a learning process for me. And now I just graduated from Georgetown University School of Foreign Service. And now I'm mentoring at APCSS. I am so, so grateful for this opportunity to be here in Hawaii in APCSS and to be on the show. So thank you again, Dr. Minnick. And that's how I came here.
I was thinking about the last time I was in Taiwan. Actually, it was too long ago. It was in December of 1999. So that was a few years ago.
And that was before I was born. Yes.
Thank you for that. I kind of remember because I was there about a week, and one of the events I did, I went to the Chiang Kai-shek National Memorial Hall and theater.
Yeah.
And I saw, it was at Christmas time, I saw Peking opera troupe's performance of Exodus. And I like to visit, you know, do culture when I'm abroad, and amazing performance.
Absolutely.
And amazing facilities. Oh my goodness. And getting ready to do this made me reflect upon so many different memories I had from the time. And so I am so excited to have this discussion. Let's dive right into it. Let's talk about Taiwan's divided government. I mean, I talked a bit about it in the monologue, but Taiwan is now in its third era of a divided government.
Right.
President Lai Ching-tao faces a legislature that is controlled by opposition parties, and they oppose new challenge and present these challenges for passing laws, for working across party lines. I mean, there are challenges that are being worked through.
Right.
Here's the question. How's this political division in influencing governance and legislative outcomes during these early months of President Lai's administration?
Right. So Taiwan's now, as you said, experiencing the third period of divided government. We had the first two in President Chen Shui-bian's era. Yeah. First from 2000 to 2004, and then the second from 2004 to 2008. So I think at the time when you were in Taiwan, December 1999, that was maybe right before the presidential election that elected Chen Shui-bian of the Democratic Progressive Party, which in fact realized Taiwan's first peaceful transfer of power. So for a lot of people, that was one of the most important democratization moment, right? First, when President Jiang Jingguo lifted the martial law, and then 1996, it saw the election of President Li Denghui of the Kuomintang, of the KMT, but that was the first free and open presidential election of the Republic of China on Taiwan. So that was also an important moment. And then subsequently, it was the election of President Chen Shui-bian of the DPP. It's very interesting looking back because he had all the different profiles that are just not, he had all the different profiles not similar to all the preceding presidents before him. And just an interesting anecdote, he is from Tainan. He graduated from my high school, in fact. So we had a very good tradition of good Taiwanese Southerner politicians graduating from the high school. So felt honored to be part of that history. Now we're having President Lai Ching-te presiding over the third divided government era. I think for the last 8 years, for the 8 years before President Lai Ching-te's presidency, President Tsai Ing-wen really ruled the Republic of China with full confidence. She had record-breaking votes for him. Yeah. She had a majority, a very comfortable majority of the DPP in the LY. So the deputy speakers were all DPP, majority leader was DPP. So she ruled with confidence and with immense comfort. But this is not what President Lai Ching-te right now is enjoying. He only received 40% of the presidential votes because 30 something percent went to Hou Yi, my candidate, when I was working for him. And another 20 something went to Ko Wen-zhou, a third party candidate. So he only got 40 out of 100%.
40 in a three way race is a plurality. It certainly is not majority, but it is tough to do in a three way race.
And so it is.
You're correct. That represents 60% of the people that didn't vote for him.
That's yes. Right. No, absolutely.
Yep.
And now his party only has 51 seats in the legislative yuan out of 113. So now, in fact, is an opposition majority. And because the third party, the TPP, Taiwan's People's Party,
that's right.
The former leader of that party, was politically prosecuted,
right,
and was indicted, I believe, but I am not sure. I'm not sure where the case is now.
Yeah.
But he
stepped down and another leader took over.
Another leader took over. So now there is a bad blood between the TPP and the DPP, which compelled the TPP to be more aligned with the main opposition, the KMT. And by political prosecution, that is at least what the TPP felt.
That's right.
And that really fermented the opposition alignment, because before that, if the opposition parties were already aligned, why were there two separate tickets instead
right.
of one?
That's right.
Right. So this is, in a way, democracy in its own doing, because originally it was a split ticket, and originally we were going to the legislative session in a three-way race. But now, seemingly, the two opposition parties are aligned against the ruling party in minority. So that is what President Lai is facing. And since the beginning of the first session of this legislative run in February last year, in February 2024, President Lai has opposed many opposition initiatives in the LY. For example, the legislative reform of the LY.
A lot the of LY, people... the legislative yuan, or the legislative branch of the government. Yeah, go ahead.
Yes. A lot of people thought the legislative yuan, the legislative branch of the Republic of China, Taiwan, was too powerless.
Yeah.
And quite honestly, before and all the presidential administrations before that, there are always scholars, academians, and just researchers believing that the Republic of China has to increase its executive legislative power balance so that the legislative power can increase its legislative scrutiny against the executive.
Yeah.
Because before that, imagine that in the US Congress, the chairman of the HVAC wants this piece of information from the State Department, and then they and they could request it from the State Department, and there are real tools to enforce it. Whereas in the ROC, the Republic of China, the ROC LY, if the chairman of the Foreign Affairs National Defense Committee so requested to, let's say, the Ministry of National Defense, there are no tools to reinforce it whatsoever. So the ministry could either just ignore it or gave you two pages of A4 papers and just leave it at that. So one of the most important elements to legislative reforms was the power to request. But of course, all of these initiatives were later ruled unconstitutional because of all the 15 supreme, for all the 15 justices, high justices, in the ROC Judiciary Yuan in the Constitutional Court, all of them were DPP appointees.
Yeah.
So the opposition faced the legislative setback. Even can still face legislative setback, even though the opposition now has a majority in the legislative run, and that really soured the ruling party opposition party relationship. Since the beginning of Lai Ching-te's presidency, he has never invited opposition leaders to have a conversation with him. I think it was a month ago, he invited opposition leaders to have a briefing of important governmental priorities, but the opposition leaders turned it down because if it were a briefing, and briefing in their by their nature are a one side are a one sided are of a one sided nature, they didn't feel that it's in conversation in equality. It's more like I'm going in to receive a lecture by the ruling party. So we don't have in Taiwan, we don't have a good executive legislative relationship. We don't have a ruling party and opposition relationship. And now there is the grand recall movement that's going on that is primarily pushed by DPP aligned civil societies, right? They have.
I want to go into the grand recall. Before you do that, I want to make sure that. Some of the terms, some of the things we've said aren't lost in some of the groups. So you laid out three parties there. You talked about, the DPP, the Democratic Progressive Party. That's a left centrist party, very focused on sovereignty, issues of sovereignty.
Right.
The party which you have worked with before, the Kuomintang, that'd be right centrist,
central right.
Central
right.
Very much focused on, defense and and issues of Chinese one China to, how would you say that?
So the KMT has always had a one China principle.
Yeah.
But this one China principle is starkly different from that of the Chinese Communist Party. The Chinese Communist
of
Party
course,
they have a one China principle. It's called there's only one China in the world. It's
Yeah.
called the People's Republic of China.
Yeah.
Whereas for the KMT, and to be fair, the constitution of my country, there is the one China principle called there is only one China called the Republic of China. So these are, in a way, how there are still competing priorities between the KMT and the major opponent, the CCP, right across the strait, where they just see their countries as very different, in a very different format.
Yeah.
They have different outlook for this concept called China, and even the names are different.
Yeah. And so left and right, and then in the center you had the TPP, the
right.
Taiwan
People's
Party,
yep.
which is kind of maybe
catch all Big Ten
technocrats that are very focused on the economy and technology and maybe issues like that. Is that kind of fair?
Yeah, I think they're more of a charismatic
yep.
party, because the former leader, Ko Wen-chuk, former mayor of Taipei, he has the ability to generate a substantial amount of support just by himself.
Yep.
So that's how he
yeah.
received
yeah.
more than 20% of the votes for
that's
a presidential
right.
election, which is impressive.
Significant. Yeah, for a third party. That's
for a third party.
That is significant.
Yes.
And so then the KMT, the TPP, working together in the legislative yuan
right.
against
the
DPP,
ruling party,
making it extremely difficult to for them to govern the way they would like, or the way you had mentioned the previous administration.
Right, during President Tsai
Ing-wen's
administration.
Yeah. yeah. So now with that, let's as we think about the grand recall push, I mean, the civil society organizations, DPP aligned groups, I mean, they've launched this unprecedented recall campaign that is targeting dozens of opposition leaders, right? Primarily from the Kuomintang, and they're
yeah.
using Taiwan's democratic mechanisms to challenge that legislative majority. So
right.
here's the question. What does this growing recall movement, what does it reveal about political polarization, civic mobilization, or even how democratic tools are being used and perceived in Taiwan today? What do
right,
you
think? Absolutely. So this so-called grand recall movement,
yeah.
Who gave this movement the name? Ke Jianming, the minority leader in the LY, so of the DPP. He said that he founded the movement, that he pushed, that he is pushing for the movement. That's all on the news.
Yeah.
So I think it's fair to say that it's the DPP-aligned civil society organizations are behind this grant recall movement, because we see, for example, one of the legislative candidates from the DPP, and Shenzhou, was the leader of the signature drive.
Okay.
Was the leader of the signature drive against for recalling one of the KMT legislators in Shenzhou, who she ran against. And we saw former legislative staffers of a DPP legislator who lost the 2024 election are part of the recall movement staff. So I think it's just a fair description of the nature of this movement, which is partisan mobilization in a effectively polarized society. And I think it's very unfortunate in a way that Taiwan till now is still facing immense threat from the Chinese Communist Party. It is the moment for us to come together as a country to face a common threat. However, this administration so far has not really done a good job in their relationship with the opposition party. Like, I am not saying that during the Tsai Ing-wen administration, the ruling party and the opposition party relationship was, you know, the best of all time, but
it's even more fractured now is what you're thinking.
A lot more fractured. And I think if we're even thinking how, if like the fact that we thought Tsai Ing-wen did a better job in managing her relationship with the opposition party, we know how bad the ruling party, opposition party relationship is right now. And the grant recall movement are all targeted at KMT legislators. And I believe the vote is on July 26th.
Yeah, this month, yeah.
Yes. And once the recall, once the recall elections are done, the legislators that are recalled, their constituency will have to face another election, which is like who is going to be the next legislator
Right.
for the district. And I think the current assessment is there are a couple KMT legislators that are more in a dangerous zone,
Likely
like
to
in
be
a
recalled.
yes,
Yeah.
like that who are more likely to be recalled. Like there are, I believe, 3 to 6 of them. But in my own assessment, even though they might be recalled,
Yeah.
there's still a chance where KMT, or even if they co-opt with the TPP can gain the seat.
Yeah.
Because if a legislator is getting recalled, like there is a recall election against him,
Right.
the leading group that sponsors the recall election can raise funds for themselves. Like the political fundraising activity
Right.
is permitted in this regard,
Yeah.
but it is not allowed under current Taiwanese law for the legislator who is being actively campaigned against. So in a way, recall
Yeah.
elections are already an unfair competition between those that want to
Seek
recall the
it. Yeah.
legislator and the legislator seek to defend
Yeah.
themselves.
Yeah, no, and I understand that this is predicated on you go back into the community, you got to get somebody's signatures to try to get people to agree to recall them, and then if they reach that threshold,
Right.
then there's a recall motion, and so the essence of this is that's where their focus is more than on governing. It's on trying to retain their seats, right? And
Right.
so that's part of the problem that's being that the legislative branch is having right now is that they're fighting for their seats
Right.
again.
The ruling
Okay.
party thought it's easier to recall opposition legislators than sticking to work with them. Yeah.
Okay. Well, watch this space because we'll have results here later this month, I'm sure.
Yes.
But let's pull on and let's talk about the defense budget debates that are
Absolutely.
going on. So,
Yes.
I mean, as I mentioned, Taiwan's defense spending is currently at 2.38% of GDP. And that is, I mean, it's drawn attention both at home and abroad as we're hearing calls for to raise that to 3.4% or even as high as 10%. And so here's the question then. How is Taiwan approaching decisions about increasing their defense spending, and what factors are in fact shaping its priorities, especially in terms, when we think about the fiscal capacity, the legislative dynamics, and even
Right.
shifts towards the asymmetric capabilities that are perhaps needed? What are your thoughts?
Right. President Lai has done a good job in making sure that increasing Taiwan's national defense spending is a priority of this administration. He said 3%,
That's what he's,
I think,
yep.
a couple months ago, which I think is welcomed by decision makers, lawmakers in America. Although some people still think that it's not enough, but I personally think it's a good step forward because it went from 2.45% to 3%. And I remember when we were campaigning in 2024, our candidate said defense budget should be adjusted to the level of threat that we are facing. And now, because the level of threat we're facing is high, the national defense spending should go above how it was naturally. So this is a welcomed development. I don't think it's realistic to ask any liberal democracy to raise their defense spending by 5% overnight. It's just impossible in terms of budget for the budget cycle, right? Because you need to get everyone approved, and there might be some quarrels against this increase. Some people will think that, oh, like we're now just raising defense budget without really thinking through how we are going to use those budgets. And the fact that we still need to think about how to use those defense budget might mean that we are not ready to raise the defense budget because we're essentially just trying to raise the defense budget for nothing. We're just raising it for the sake of raising it.
So there has to be a plan that they're going to work towards, is what you're saying. And then
yes.
they need to be able to present that and then be able to vote on it. And
yes.
And then a divided, contentious legislature come to consensus to be able to put forward the money to spend, is what you're saying.
Yes, absolutely. Because at this very moment, the government, the opposition party, the Foreign Affairs National Defense Committee of the LY, they're all scrambling to put forward a special budget for national defense. It's a long-standing practice in Taiwan that when it comes to, for example, defense acquisition, for example, defense investment, a special budget is required. Like at least over the last 3 years, a special defense budget is required so that there can be deliberation, proper deliberation for exactly on exactly what items are we spending the money. And I remember there was a naval air special defense. And this year, we are trying to, and this year, we're trying to seek out what the US government is thinking, what they're thinking of selling us. Because the process of defense acquisition is not just, oh, Taiwan's saying we want to buy item A, item B, and C, and then the US government will give it, will sell it, will agree to sell it to Taiwan. It's a mutual process. It's for the Taiwan to request, it's for the Taiwanese authorities to request it, but it's also for the American authorities to agree to sell it to Taiwan. And a lot of times when there are competing priorities and when there are different interpretations of how Taiwan and the United States come together to meet this common danger, when there are different interpretations for that, there might be different thinkings as to, oh, maybe we need more M1A2T tanks. Maybe we need more M109A6 pelleting howitzers. Maybe we need more sea mines. Maybe we need more Switchblade 300 drones. So there are a lot of discussions still ongoing, but I think it's very, very important before we make any spending commitment that we really parse out what we need to buy that is in the most efficient way, because, like, to be honest, we just don't have the money, we just don't have the manpower to meet the People's Liberation Army, the PLA, on all conventional levels. We will never have the same amount of military personnel. We will never have the same amount of fighter jets. We will never have the same amount of main battle tanks. So it's incredibly important for us to gradually switch to a, as you said, asymmetric posture for Taiwan to defend itself. But I myself is personally concerned about the extreme call for Taiwan to switch entirely to a asymmetric posture or a so-called porcupine strategy, because in an event where there's only drones, sea mines, anti-ship missiles in Taiwan, we won't be able to intercept PLAAF incursions into our ADIZ anymore. We won't be able to fend off PLA maritime militias incursions anymore. We won't be able to engage in any counter-blockade operations anymore against the PLA. So the questions, and so this fact begs the question, which I'm still seeking the answer. I don't think there is the best answer in the world. I think every analyst in the world has their own answer. And I hope that the Taiwanese government can come up with the answer as soon as possible, is how can we balance our defense budget, our defense spending in asymmetric and symmetric, so conventional equipment in a way that does not sacrifice either capability.
Yeah, no, fascinating. And thanks for the depth of thinking on that. I mean, you laid out rightly, it's probably not a either or, and like most things in life, it's some combination. And so then you're asking, what level of combination are we talking about, and how,
Yes.
and what do we need to be able to achieve maximum benefit,
And how to integrate it.
and how to integrate it? Yeah, no, extremely complicated. I'm going to go ahead and pull us into some other thoughts, because either one of these, I imagine we could spend an entire episode just
Oh, we
talking
can.
about. And this is a bit of a
Absolutely.
survey, but having you here with the depth and firsthand experience and working on a number of these issues, as spoke about your portfolios previously, this is quite interesting. Let's talk about the U.S.-Taiwan expectations. I mean, without a doubt, U.S. support for Taiwan remains strong. I mean, but it is, these evolving regional dynamics and delays in some of the defense deliveries. In fact, I'm reminded of the recent paper you just wrote for the
East
War on the
Asia
Rock.
Forum.
That one was just very recently, a little earlier, on War on the Rocks. But talking about some of these defense delivery delays and stuff, I mean, let me ask you this question then. So, how are Taiwanese leaders and the broader public viewing their strategic relationship with the United States, and in what ways is Taiwan engaging with partners like the United States to strengthen its defense cooperation?
So I don't think we're doing enough in engaging in international partners, aside from the United States. But part of it is also because of the special status of Taiwan. It makes it harder for countries other than the United States to engage, to have a special defense relationship with Taiwan. Like before, in like maybe like several decades ago, you had the French Republic selling their fighter jets to Taiwan. But after a period of time, they started scaling back. And after they scaled back, Taiwan has been struggling to find the components to perform maintenance on the fighter jets. So most of them are rendered obsolete, and that's just not good investment. And
No, you're absolutely right. The critical thing about defense procurements is, how do you sustain it in for the long term? If you just buy it, put it on the shelf, it'll quickly degrade. And so, yeah, those are.
And for other defense partners, for example, possible defense partners, for example, the Republic of Korea, they have a booming defense
Yeah, very
industry,
robust.
very robust, right? But is it realistic that Taiwan request to buy defense equipment from Korea? Like, for one, there's the issue of pride, right? Like, Taiwan has always prided themselves as, oh, like, we are the number one in the Four Dragons of Asia, and we started investing in our own defense industry a lot earlier than the Republic of
We
Korea,
did.
but somehow the Republic of China, Taiwan, fell behind. And second, is it in the ROK's interest to sell defense items to Taiwan? Third, as you pointed out very well, is it sustainable? We see peaceful transfer of powers, well, sometimes not very peaceful, but peaceful transfer powers at all times in the Republic of Korea. There are administrations where they're more friendly towards Taiwan, friendly towards the United States, and more careful when it comes to their relationship with the Chinese Communist Party. But there are also administrations where they're maintain good ties with the United States, with Taiwan, but also have a friendlier ties with Beijing. And does that make the Republic of Korea exposed to PRC coercion?
So those are some considerations that you have to take, that Taiwan takes into consideration as they're trying to think about how they.
When they seek defense partners in the world. And I think the most important factor is still that Taiwan being in such a contentious relationship with mainland China just does not help in expanding their substantial, not just like, verbal support, but substantial relationship with countries outside of the United States of America. And at this point, Taiwan, of course, wants robust relationship with the United States, defense, commercial, economic, education, intellectual exchange, all that. But this current administration of the United States is in a way has really disrupted the alliance structure. Well, alliance can be a, well, let's say it's alliance structure in East Asia. The trade deal with Japan and they're all okay, are all released, 25% tariff, and Taiwan's falling behind, which is fine because there's always a sequence, and I don't think Taiwan is in a hurry to say that, oh, you know what, we need an answer tomorrow, which would be a very good scenario, but it's not a pressure that we would want to put on our on American authorities. But there is a growing concern where what if Taiwan's tariff, no, America's tariff on Taiwan after the trade talks, after the trade deal, becomes higher than that of 25%. We all know that Taiwan and the ROK has a competing commercial relationship since mid-century in the 20th century, mid-20th century. All of our industrial exports are very similar.
Yes.
We all manufacture and export semiconductors. We all manufacture and export cars. Well, Taiwan did, but Taiwan fell out of favor because of competition. We do a lot of similar things, and that is what Taiwan is afraid. Because what if today ROK is 25%, Japan's 25%, ROC is 35%, and that way, all the equipment that we are all the commodities that we're trying to sell to America, or even just the internal processing of those commodities in Taiwan just becomes a lot more expensive than our other Asian counterparts. And that would seriously stifle Taiwan's competitiveness. It would not crash our economy. I think, Taiwan will still be Taiwan, but the economic growth of Taiwan will be stifled, decreased tremendously. And I don't think that's something in the United States' interest to see. Because if you want Taiwan to remain strong, if you want Taiwan to spend more budget on defense, if you want Taiwan to spend more on civilian resilience, it requires money, and still requires a good trade relationship with the rest of the world, with the rest of the world. And if Taiwanese export industries are so affected, and Taiwanese competitiveness is decreased, it will put Taiwan in a very awkward spot where we, at some point, even if we want to help ourselves or to help America to help us, we wouldn't even have the ability to do that. And that's extremely dangerous.
Yeah, well, there's a multiplicity of challenges that you're bringing up. This is complex, is what you're saying, without a doubt. Now, time is screaming by us here, Howard. Let's talk real quickly about a few other issues. I wanted to ask you about cross-strait gray zone tensions. I mean, I brought it up. Last year alone, 5,100 incursions of the AZ. And so, let me ask you this question. So, how is Taiwan responding to these ongoing gray zone tactics, and what measures is Taiwan taking to strengthen the resilience without escalating tensions? I mean, it's a bit of a balance, right?
No, absolutely. I think in terms of escalation, it's well known that the Chinese Communist Party doesn't trust our current president. They see like the current president Lai Ching-te as a similar form as former president Chen Shui-bian, and they come from a tradition that is heavily invested in Taiwanese independence movement. So in a way, whatever Lai Ching-te does, it's prone to be escalatory in the eyes of the Chinese Communist Party. But at the same time, in the national addresses that President Lai Ching-te has given, he has opted into the use of words such as the ROC and the PRC are not subordinate to each other. The PRC has no right to represent Taiwan. If anything, the ROC is the motherland of the PRC because the ROC is in its 114 years and the PRC is in its like 76 or something like that. So, which I found the last one very funny, right? Because when I'm saying it, I'm still smiling. But you don't have to say that to make your point. There are a million other ways to go about it. And you selected the probably the most controversial way to put it. If you take out these couple sentences out of your addresses, it's a perfect address, right? It addresses defense, resilience, economy, trade, culture, and your own DPP priorities. I think that's great. But there are just a couple sentences if you take out and if you take out some of them, you're still making your point, and you will in a way de-escalate the you will de-escalate the crossroad
Tensions,
relations
yeah.
whenever it could go the other way around whenever it could go the other way.
Yeah.
Because whenever you say that, whenever he said that, there's always more like intensified combat readiness patrol operations. Whenever he said that, sometimes there would be a larger scale, a military drill in the Taiwan Strait against Taiwan. And I think these can be properly avoided it. But in preparing Taiwan's own defense, I think this administration is doing a good job in their annual military drill called Hanguang, and this is the 41st
That's going on right
year.
now.
Yeah, which is going on right now, and this is the longest version ever in Hanguang military exercise history. As we're speaking now, it's July 11th, so we are on.
Day two or three, maybe,
Oh wait,
and
we're
it's a
not.
10-day exercise, something like that.
Yeah, sorry, it's July 10th, so we are on the second day.
Okay.
And the first, so it's so before this version, it's always 5 days. This version, 10. First 4 days, it's Taiwanese response to great to intense gray zone PLA gray zone operations turn invasion. The fifth day. So it's only one day is phase two, which is Taiwanese response to PLA targeted attack on critical infrastructure and military installment. And the last 5 days would be PLA amphibious assault on Taiwanese shores and later turned into a civil defense situation. So it went from the shores into the cities and the counties. And this time around, they enlisted the help of 22,000 reservists. And this is also the biggest ever enlistment of reservists for a annual military exercise like that, because the Taiwanese Ministry of National Defense is trying to test the support from the Taiwanese reservists, not just on the battalion level, but on a brigade level.
On the brigade level?
Yes, on a
Yeah.
brigade level. And there are news reports that AIT officials are there to observe it, which they should, because at the end of the day, it is in the com it's in the mutual interest of Taiwan and the United States that we understand what the operations on each side is, and to seek out interoperability and joint training, for example. And this is, I think, this is the demonstration of the Taiwanese resolve against brazen tactics, seeing how for the first 4 days, phase one of the largest military exercise is dedicated to brazen tactics. But brazen tactics are not just PLA maritime militia, PLA coast guard operations. It's more than that. It's disinformation. It's trust into our democratic institutions. And on that front, Taiwan has been ramping up civilian fact check organizations to help combating disinformation that are po that that is possibly spread from Ch Ch the Chinese Communist Party. And on the trust of democratic institutions, I was reading a news about the Republic of Korea the other day, and I saw that there are some doubts into the electoral integrity of the last Korean presidential election, right after President Yoon's impeachment. And it was a Democratic Party victory, and it was some conservative personnel questioning the election. I was thinking about it, and it just came to my mind that the Chinese Communist
And
Party doesn't
that's going on right
really,
now.
yeah, it,
Need
which is going on right now, and this is their longest
their
version
favorable
ever
candidate
in
to be
Hanguang
elected in order
ex
to
exilheim
claim
history.
victory
As we're speaking now, it's July 11th,
in
so
their
we are on
day two or
influence
three, maybe.
oh wait
Maybe
we're
it's a 10-day
the
exercise, something like that.
yeah
No,
the
sorry,
Democratic
it's
Party,
July
July 10th, so we are
10th.
on the second day
Okay.
the
Democratic
and the
Party is
first so it's so more favored in a way, or they have friendlier relationship with the People's Republic of China. But even though that is the electoral fact, as long as the CCP can sow doubts into the Korean population about the electoral integrity to decrease the public trust in their democratic institutions,
Yeah,
it's
that's a real.
still a CCP victory, because the essence of a liberal democracy is democratic participation and trust in the result. So even if now, let's say, some friendlier parties to China and Japan wins the election, as long as the CCP has the opportunity to make sure that politicians from the other side of the aisle in Japan distrust the electoral integrity of the election, that gives operational space for CCP infiltration operations. That makes these liberal democracies, Taiwan, Korea, Japan, more exposed to CCP coercion and threats. And that is the core part of civilian resilience, democratic resilience, that I think we should pay attention to.
I'm going to ask you two quick questions and then we'll quickly go on. But I brought up in the monologue about countering PRC's espionage efforts. And surprisingly, Taiwan has had quite a few espionage cases.
Oh, yeah.
I'm reading them in the news today. And even very recently, they've convicted military personnel. Even there was surveillance of the vice president-elect at the time. Xiao, when she was abroad. And so how is Taiwan strengthening these counterintelligence postures in response to these incidents? And then maybe what broader measures are being taken to safeguard against PRC's infiltration? I'm going to hold you to quick answers.
I want to make the point that national security doesn't equate to mainland policy. You can have a hardline mainland policy that you hate the Chinese communists to the guts, you want to kill all of them, but you're still very careless. You're still very you still haven't put in a thought into national security, and it's like, and I think that's what's happening right now. Mirror Media of Taiwan, it's a proven pro-government, pro-current government media. They exposed the case of a recent espionage, of the recent CCP espionage case in Taiwan, happening at the center of power, in the office of the Minister of Foreign Affairs, in the office of the Secretary General of the National Security Council, in the office of the office of the Speaker of the Legislative Yuan, the legislative branch. And not just the schedules were compromised. Vice President Xiao's personal information, contact information, and possibly more were compromised as well. And I think what happened to Vice President-elect at the time in April 2024 in the Czech Republic was just so unfortunate that our Taiwan's Vice President-elect can receive transnational oppression abroad in Europe, in Czech Republic. Arguably one of the most friendliest states towards European states towards Taiwan. And that just goes to show that when we're doing our outreach in other countries, we still have to pay attention to what information are we keeping to ourselves, and how wh why did it go wrong, right? So only a handful of people know Vice President-elect Xiao's schedule because she was out there in the Czech
That's
Republic.
right.
Was that because of a loophole on the Czech side, or was it because something went wrong within the Taiwanese government or office of VP-elect Xiao? Because it has to be something, right? It's not that the CCP agents in the Czech Republic just ran into VP-elect Xiao's vehicle in the middle of nowhere in Prague. There has to be prior planning, and so there has to be a loophole that happened in the information that we keep, either on Taiwanese side or on the Czech side. But the cases that were con the person the people work who were working for Joseph Wu, who were working for Speaker Yeo Si-kwun, they had the amount of information they had, they were not properly classified. There's no real security measures as to how they should protect confidential information. And that led to the unfortunate incident that VP Xiao could have been murdered in the Czech Republic. So that just goes back to my point where mainland policy never equates to national security. You can have a hardline mainland policy, you still can be very careless in your national security.
Yeah, no, and I do understand that there's a number of efforts that are being undertaken to try to ratchet this down. But
Yes.
oh my goodness, this has been a wonderful hour together. I think what we'll do though is before I let you go, I want to ask you to suggest a book recommendation for our audience.
Absolutely. The book I will recommend would be Admiral Lee Shiming, the ROC Admiral Lee Shiming's book on overall defense concept. So by reading the book, you get a peek into what Taiwanese defense could have been. He's definitely on the side of the spectrum where he advocates for a lot more asymmetric posture than Taiwan currently has, but it really helps you to understand the current debate in Taiwan and in the United States on Taiwan about whether or about how we should prioritize defense investment, defense acquisition that helps Taiwan to defend itself. And unfortunately, that idea was disbanded after he retired in, I remember, 2018 or 2019. But he published a book, and that idea is still very much cherished in certain defense communities in Taiwan and also in the United States. So if you want to understand more about the current debate on defense posture in Taiwan, I wholeheartedly recommend you to read Admiral Lee Shiming's book on overall defense concept and become a Taiwanese defense expert.
Yeah, no, that's wonderful. We'll add that to the show notes. Thank you so much for your time with us today.
Thank you so much, Dr. Minnick, for having me on the show. I had so much fun, and hopefully this conversation has really helped you on your understanding of Taiwanese politics, Taiwanese defense, and its relationship with the United States.
No, wonderful. As we conclude today's dialogue, we're reminded that Taiwan's strength lies in its ability to uphold democratic values while adapting to shifting strategic realities. Its future depends not only on external partnerships, but also on the resilience, clarity, and unity of its people at home. These conversations shape security. Join us on July 16th when I sit down with Elsa Kania, a leading expert on China's military innovation, emerging technologies, and strategy, to unpack the PLA's evolving doctrine, capabilities, and potential surprises in future Indo-Pacific conflict. On behalf of all of us at DKIEPCSS, thank you for being part of this important dialogue. I'm James Minnick, and until we meet again, aloha hoi.
As always, the opinions expressed in this program do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of DKIEPCSS, the U.S. Department of Defense, or the U.S. government.